Hello everyone, I'm Matt Berry. This is the first episode of a series of conversations with Jean-Michel Jarre at his studio in Paris. Today, we'll be talking about the early years. So let's go right back to when would you say that you realized that that music was important to you?
Music has always been part of my environment, and I've been really lucky. Not, and funnily enough, a lot of people are thinking that it's because of my dad, because my dad being a composer. But my parents split up when I was 5 years old, and then I grew up really far away from his influence. He was in Hollywood, and I was in Paris, and it's more my mom who took care of me, and probably also gave me the first connections with music. And I mean, the first I remember that we had the old 78 records at home, I mean, left by my dad when he left, and these collections were probably coming from when he was himself a teenager or something.
Yeah.
And then I had this contact with classical music. The first music I remember is The Rite of Spring by Stravinsky, and I was scared by that because I was, four or five, six years old, and it was quite a very strong piece of music, and it then, probably because of that, is probably what my favorite piece of classical music. And also some different things from early Italian music and the early Italian songs. And also Umm Kulthum, you had some recording from Umm Kulthum, this Arabic singer. And then I started to study piano. But I would say that my real connection with music is more through sounds. And I realized that recently.
Yeah.
I'm born in Lyon, and even if I was living in Paris with my mom, all my holidays I was going to Lyon at my grandparents' place, and my grandparents were living in front of the main railway station called the Gare de Perrache. It's the main railway station in Lyon. Between the railway station and their apartment, you had this big square where you had a circus coming regularly.
Right.
And when I was going there for summer holidays, and it was very quite hot, the windows were open, and the sounds going from this window was very special. It was a mixture of the sound of the circus, you know, when you hear kind of muffled type of sounds of what was going on under this big chapiteau, this big tent.
Yeah.
And also, downstairs, you had the big cafes that you have most of the time in front of the stations, full of soldiers and whores, until, of course, very late at night.
Yeah.
And this very strange mixture of sounds, I mean, for me, was like a kind of music.
Yeah.
That was probably my first conscious contact with what sounds are about. And also my grandfather used to be a quite interesting character because he was an engineer, but he was an inventor. He created one of the first mixing desks before the war. He did also the grandfather of the iPod with what's the kind of first portable turntable.
All right.
And then he was also playing the oboe. So, I mean, his atelier was like a dream zone, in
yeah,
a sense.
Yeah.
And then he was dealing also with lots of sounds, and that's probably my contact with music is probably why, and I really realized that recently, because it's probably why I've been interested by later on Pierre Schaeffer and exploring sounds exploring music through sounds rather than just with a piece of paper and a score.
sort of natural sounds then.
Yeah, that's right. Exactly. Raw sounds to process them. And then when my grandfather gave me my first tape recorder, it was a German Grundig type of half-inch tape recorder, and I used to process that by I made a mistake by playing the tape reverse, and suddenly I was processing sounds. Even in my early days when I started to play as a kid in rock, some local rock bands, I was used to processing sounds. So it was really my real contact with music is also very, very close to my approach to sounds in general.
Yeah, because it's very similar to Ennio Morricone, who I know that you're a fan of.
Yes, of course.
Where you see the early interviews of him, and he says that the biggest kind of thrill that he had was bringing typewriters and these kind of, and two bits of wood, you know, within the orchestra. So the sort of natural sound thing is what got you excited, would you say? And then that could be applied to more sort of conventional music.
Yeah, I mean, you know, talking about the new Morricone, I remember that, you know, you had something very, very popular in avant-garde music, where you have this kind of what we call prepared piano, you know, where we put lots of crazy objects in the piano, coins and glass and lots of things.
Yeah.
And actually, at my grandparents' home, you had a piano that my father used to play when he was still at his parents' home, and probably also some other members of the family. And this piano was not used anymore. And you had some objects inside that. I know my grandma and grandmother put and all that. And then I remember that I was playing as a young child this piano with very strange sound because it was unconsciously prepared piano unprepared piano.
Yeah, yeah.
And that was also
prepared.
Something, yes, I mean, by accident. And that also gave me also the idea of twisting and twisting some instruments. And it's strange how things happens in, as we know, it's almost banal to say that, but it's, I mean, life is made so much of accidents that being crucial in your evolution, or crucial in the direction you are going to take.
Yes, absolutely. You
know, and that's something which, in my case, is absolutely true. And the other thing also I remember that is this story that you probably maybe heard about my first encounter with Chet Baker. My mom was a great figure in the French Resistance, and when she stayed at in a concentration camp, she became quite close to a woman. She became one of her best friends after the war, and she had the most popular jazz club, modern jazz club in Paris called Le Chat qui Pêche.
Right.
And Rue de la Huchette in Saint-Germain-des-Prés, and where you had lots of great jazzmen like Chet Baker and John Coltrane and Artie Chep and Don Cherry and people like this.
Yeah.
And I was going with my mom visiting her friend, and I was just hanging around and going down in the club. And in the Sunday afternoon, I mean, just watching these guys rehearsing, I had no idea about who they were. And I remember that for my eighth birthday, I mean, Chet Baker sat me on the upright piano and he played the trumpet for me for five minutes. Mm. And I was so impressed, not because of Chet Baker, because I didn't know exactly how great he was. But I, each time I remember this, I feel the air of the instrument on my chest. And this is one of the really very strong moments where I felt the physical impact of sound on your body, which is not, for lots of people, music. And at that moment, at that stage, in European music, in Europe, music has always been something quite intellectual or cerebral.
Yeah.
Where you are writing some notes on a piece of paper, and you give this piece of paper to musicians to play the music you have in your mind. It's the most abstract activity you can think about. And suddenly I had this kind of direct physical experience with music.
Yeah. That's incredible that it would be Chet Baker, because in the UK, it would, for most people my age and sort of slightly older, they usually say Top of the Pops.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, sure.
Because there's a colourful programme in your front room with someone or some people, you know, who when you're small, look like they're from outer space, do you know what I mean? With some sounds that you've never heard before. And people always, you know, people sort of tend to say in the UK that it's Top of the Pops.
Yeah,
that is the thing that kind of first.
Yeah.
Because it wasn't on late. So as a kid, you could actually, you know, sort of watch it.
Yeah. You know, it's probably coming from, I totally understand that. I know that. I would make the main difference between UK and France for that. I mean, in those days, and now it has changed, but historically, France always had been more a country based on literature and movies and cinema.
Yeah.
And music is not secondary, but not as it is in the UK. In the UK, where it is probably one of the most, if not the most important art form in the pop world. And we didn't have kind of Pop of the Pops. Then later on, it was a very basic version or cheesy version of Top of the Pops. So I totally understand. I did it a few times, Top of the Pops. And even the experience was like being out of space. The whole thing. I mean, suddenly being live on TV was something totally, totally crazy. And I agree that in this little window that these TVs were with the round screen, I mean, it was like a kind of Forbidden Planet or Star Trek type of experience. I mean, something coming from the outside world.
Yeah.
Where here in France, you had to find your own way. To quest for music was something not that obvious.
Yeah.
But in my case, it's just a matter of circumstances. What I'm telling you is actually something which is very unusual. I mean, this kind of of moments. And that, of course, influenced me some way to go for electroacoustic music and electronic music later on, probably.
Sure. What sort of came first for you? Would it have been the guitar or the tape recorder? And did you exchange one for the other?
Actually, when I had this tape recorder, I was very, very interested to experiment with it without knowing what I was going to do. This is the proper meaning of experimentation.
Yeah.
And then when I started with some of my early rock bands, we were used to record, but also I used to process sounds of guitar solo or things I was doing, strange noise, without knowing that some people were doing this more, of course, more professionally or more advanced. Later on, when I had this, so I had my guitar and my amp, and which is quite symbolic, is actually I decided to sell this guitar, this amp, and also my small electric train. That was really something very special. It was a German electric train that I had when I was a kid that my grandfather told me. And, you know, he built that, you know, on the piece of plywood, you know, with painted with fake trees and all that. So it was like a treasure. So I sold this at the flea market in Paris and with my electric guitar, my amp, to afford a trip to London to buy my first synthesizer.
Oh my God.
So it was very, very symbolic of rejecting the establishment of rock to dive into
Well, that's really important,
music.
Isn't it?
Yeah. It's
so that was the EMS that you bought
in
London.
That's right.
And it's over there. I can see it.
Yes, the one, yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, the first one. It's still working.
Yeah, because there's footage of you in a band playing the guitar that was used in a film.
Yeah.
So that was the end of that for you. So you sold everything then and then
it went into the, so it was quite dramatic.
Yeah.
It was quite a crucial decision.
Actually,
it was a crucial decision. I had no other choice.
Right.
Financially speaking, it was not because I wanted to get rid of my guitar. Because I loved it, but I had no choice if I wanted to purchase this VCS3.
And your thinking was that would be more exciting, and you could do more with that. So say, you know, if that was the sort of equivalent of a sort of palette of colors, you thought there was more colors.
Yeah,
with the EMS.
Suddenly, I realized that even if I always loved the guitar and any kind of instruments, first of all, I had no choice. But suddenly, I realized that the main difference for musicians is actually before electronic and electroacoustic instrument and before synthesizers. I mean, you were just dealing with existing sounds or pre-determined sounds, I mean, created by the craftsman.
Yeah.
I mean, this, so you could deal and doing wonderful things, of course, with the sound of a clarinet, the sound of a violin, the sound of a piano, and then you put all this together for to make an orchestra, and you can deal and create music based on this palette, as you said, palette of colors.
Yeah.
But with a synth, suddenly, you could be your own craftsman. You could actually create your own sounds, and then these sounds will help you to create your own music. So actually, I was suddenly realizing that it was giving me such a freedom.
Yeah.
And something to explore that has, but also in those days were not explored yet.
Yeah.
And it's, I feel very privileged, in my life to have been able to be in a certain period of time where I was allowed and I was, it was suddenly possible, and I had the opportunity to open doors on virgin territories. And because I had the feeling that what I was doing, nobody did it before.
Yeah, sure.
Or just a bunch of kids. But it, so that's something quite rare even in history of art. To be just at a moment where just things are shifting,
yeah,
and yet you, and that's the beginning of this kind of technology. I mean, just gave us the generations coming just after me also. I mean, gave us so many possibilities, and it's like when the beginning of of cinema as an art form. So it was allowing, and I think that the first actors or the first directors, I mean, dealing with a new technology, it should have been also unbelievable. So it was a little bit like this kind of exciting,
yeah.
this kind of exciting moment and really like a dream, unexpected dream.
Yeah, sure. Through. And it's important, or it's interesting that it was the EMS that you chose, because for those who don't know, I suppose, that is a piece of equipment with no keyboard.
Yeah.
That's the one that you first bought.
That's right, exactly.
Where you can make white noise as well as you can kind of control sound, you know, and make sort of sound effects and things. So that really is a piece of equipment for ideas as opposed to
exactly
something which you can make a string sound on or, you know, an oboe sound, for instance.
So I totally agree. This is the pure... Why it's still my favorite instrument, because as you said very truly, I mean, then you could add a keyboard later on, but the whole philosophy and the whole approach of this instrument is actually to make sounds,
yeah.
Not to make music.
Yeah.
And then it's the opposite of the DX7.
Yeah.
I really hated the DX7. I know that it's probably the favorite, if Brian Eno's favorite instrument, but for me,
Well, it's the best selling. Doesn't mean it's the best.
Yeah, and also because I think that electronic music always carried its own bags of paradoxes.
Yeah.
The first paradox and was the switch on bar from Walter Carlos.
Yeah.
Where it became an instant hit, but it was very, in a sense, quite negative for the idea of electronic music for everybody, that suddenly this synthesizer could be a fake electric machine to imitate orchestral sounds.
Yeah.
Which is of course not that. And it's nothing to do with the extraordinary talent of Walter Wendy Carlos.
Sure.
So that's one thing. The second thing is actually, even now, lots of people are thinking that the synthesizer is actually, you can just push a preset and you can have the sound of a violin and oboe, clarinet and all that. That's not particularly interesting, because if you want the sound of the oboe, just
use
an oboe.
Yeah.
And then the second thing is also with Kraftwerk and all the German colleagues. I mean, just having this kind of doing the apology of machines and presenting electronic instruments for doing a robotic and cold kind of approach of music. And then that also put the synthesizers and the electronic instruments in this category of no soul.
Yeah.
Something that is cold and not being really considered as an instrument. I'm talking about the early days. Even,
sure.
Of course, if people that's just as Kraftwerk and Tangerine Dream, I mean, Tangerine Dream was even leaving the stage at the end of their concert just to make the statement that actually machines were able to do music on their own.
Yeah.
So this approach also created another layer of misunderstanding with what the electronic instruments, electronic synthesizer is all about. And as you said very truly, it's actually, and the VCS3 and the AMS philosophy is exactly based on that. I mean, the idea that you can approach music through sounds first, rather than through solfeggio or notes based on any kind of classical system, which is, of course, very valuable and exciting, but it's a totally different approach.
Absolutely, yeah. It's interesting that you mention Eno, because Eno, in a way, was doing a fairly similar thing in the UK with Roxy Music, in that he was sort of hired as a keyboard player. He didn't play the keyboards, he played the VCS, he just made sort of, made noises. And used a tape recorder. I mean, he even says that the tape recorder is his main instrument.
Yeah.
Now.
He started really as a rock artist, as lots of us started. And then he went into this. I never talked about this with him, but it seems that he shifted to electronic music later on, like actually lots of British act of British people, shifting step by step, where in France and in Germany, it was probably more part of our roots because of the heritage of classical music. As we know, I mean, the core of classical music, even if you have brilliant composers in the UK, I mean, but the classical music is really originally coming from Germany and France, Italy, and actually, the concept of electroacoustic music and electronic music is coming from continental Europe.
Yeah.
Then it has been shifted with the synth pop and new wave in the early 80s. Having said that, it's of course not only entirely true, because you have lots of course, the BBC lab.
Radiophonic Workshop.
Very important, yes, of course.
Yeah.
That's very important. And just one quick thing about that. I mean, we all, for electronic musicians, we owe a lot to public radio stations.
Yeah.
Because without them, Stockhausen wouldn't be what he has done. Pierre Schaeffer, Pierre Henry, and myself, we couldn't have done what we've done without public radio and the studio, by hijacking the first electronic instruments before AMS and the VCS3 and all this. They are actually instruments for maintenance for public radio that we hijacked to make some noise with just filters and oscillators, not at all made for doing music.
Yeah.
And that's what we owe a lot to public radio stations in Europe, all over Europe.
Yeah.
And the BBC, of course, the BBC Lab, the same thing.
Sure. Because do you know the Doctor Who theme?
Yeah, sure.
So that's Delia Derbyshire. She's, as far as I know, she's using oscillators for that main...
Yes, of course.
Yeah. Which we're not obviously intended to be making.
Yeah, exactly.
Theme tunes for pro.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And one of my favorite albums of the 60s of electronic music in the UK is White Noise.
Right.
With David Vorhaus. And it's still, for me, one of the huge masterpiece of,
it's brilliant.
Of electronic music, yes.
Yeah, because he's most famous for doing... He did some library music, which Andrex Toilet Paper picked up on. And there was an advert. It's called The Sea of Tranquility, I think.
Oh, yes, exactly.
Which is a beautiful...
Yeah, fantastic, yeah.
But we just know it as this...
Yeah.
This toilet paper commercial in the UK. And it's such an insult to him, because it's a fantastic bit of music. But, you know, it just... Because with library music, as you know, anyone can just pick things, you know, to use for anything. And that's what happened to him with that. It's always made me laugh, because everything that he did was very high quality, you know, and was really different sounding, you know.
Yeah, but you know... It's also the idea that electronic music being so underground and then that it was used the only advertising commercials were probably the only way to
get it out
to get it. Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
So, I mean, you have so many people who have done that. I've done that also in my early days. I mean, doing some commercials, and it was because probably the people in the advertising business always wanting something different.
Yeah.
We're probably the most people, ironically, ready to have a different approach.
Yeah. Something interesting about you is what you did next were those short electronic pieces. The difference between that and what you ended up doing next was they all had names. So you gave all of those pieces Iranian hitchhiker and something frog and all these quite
totally crazy.
So you kind of named them all. And was that more of a sort of a demonstration of what this stuff could do, or what were you thinking of?
Actually, because it's very actually it's interesting, this question coming after just the conversation we had about the commercial, because I've been asked by the Fox in America to do a kind of series of short pieces of music for actually like music library or commercials or soundtracks or that. And then it was in days where I was very, very interested in surrealism and all this kind of oxymoron approach of in literature and ideas and all that. I said, okay, I'm going to do, in a sense, like Eric Satie, where he was doing rather serious music, but with crazy names.
Yeah.
You know, three pieces with in the shape of an apple or something like this. You know, and the crazy. And I said it could be fun to do that with so extreme different sounds and having totally crazy titles. So I did that not as a joke, but as a concept in itself. Yeah.
And then you abandon that.
Yeah.
There are exceptions. I mean, you have on Equinox, there's Band in the Rain. And then on...
But it came later on. Band in the Rain came, this title came in the Concerts of China, in a Concert in China album, where I played that on its own. And it was originally, and even in Equinox, it's still part of part eight. It was a bit of a mistake for me, because it was actually, this part was composed of two different subparts.
Sure.
And
was that a conscious decision of yours not to do that for Oxygen and for Equinox and from then on?
And yes, exactly. I think that it's funny because my next album, the new album, is actually I decided later on to put some titles again, but it was very a bit difficult for me, but I find a twist. I will tell you more about that later on. But actually the idea was, actually I always thought the reason why that we in Deserted Palace, Palace, these kind of crazy titles, because I always thought that for an instrumental piece of music, it's sometimes a bit artificial. Say, okay, I'm going to call this Monolith 41 or say, what does it mean with the music? And then if you have no lyrics, the lyrics most of the time are justifying the title.
Yeah.
But in an instrumental music, you can describe the mood, yes, but then it's the mood for me was always been the main title, like a book.
Yeah,
you don't necessarily call the chapter, each chapter of the book you're writing. So I really conceive these albums like one track with different movements or with different parts, and this is the reason why I said it was maybe not particularly commercial to think about that, because people spend a lot of time mixing the part 4, 5, 6, 7. But I really didn't care. I think that it was really making also the statement that it was something that you had to listen to in its entirety, or choosing some parts, like in classical music, you just choose a part. But actually classical music is probably an unconscious also influence from classical music, where you have, I don't know, in a symphony or concerto, you have different parts, but not necessarily with titles.
Yeah. Yeah, because Mike Oldfield, just before you, obviously had Tubular Bells.
Yeah, he did the same.
Part one and part two.
Yeah.
And when you listen to it, I mean, you could sort of carve that up into three or four parts and kind of title them, but he decided not to as well, to have it as a long form on each side, which is an interesting and quite risky thing to do.
It was totally risky. I mean, for him, like for me, where those two albums are like UFOs, you know. Oxygen has been released just in the middle of punk, where the motto was no future. And Oxygen, I would say, would be yes future question mark, with the cover and all that. It was definitely not a no future.
Yeah.
And electronic music being also linked with sci-fi and a kind of Romanesque type of vision of the future was certainly not linked to a no future.
Yeah. Okay, so this next period of time, there's hardly any information about, and you've not really talked about. So from the end of those Lacage and those instrumental albums until you're preparing for Oxygen. What were you doing? So that's from, I don't know.
Yes,
72 to 76.
Yeah. When I finished my studies with Schaeffer at the Music Research Center,
yeah.
I did actually experimented different things. The first music I composed for the outside world was actually for the French Opera House, for a ballet. It was a big privilege, again, a fantastic opportunity, because a young choreographer worked in the Festival d'Avignon, festival of theater, and he did a small ballet, and I was involved for the music for that. And then he got commissioned for the French Opera House for creating a big ballet, and then he asked me to do the music. And then it was the first time that electronic music or electroacoustic music would be played in the French Opera House. So it has been quite an experience. And then I discovered more the world of pop music or rock music system with the big studios. And for me, that was like a dream, because my knowledge about studio was the studio of public radio, where you were all in mono and multi-sources. Yeah. And the whole philosophy of electroacoustic music in those days were to be in mono, but with multi-mono instead of stereo. So I really discovered not stereo as a for album, but the way the stereo studios in stereo with when I came into this kind of private studios from owning from to EMI to public private companies. And then I've been quite blown away to experiment this. And then I started to produce some singers, from French pop singers. I wrote lots of songs, music, lyrics, and producing also different artists.
Christophe, wasn't it?
Christophe, and also Patrick Juvet, lots of, and very respected and successful artists in France. And we did together big national hits. And then that gave me the opportunity to go to Los Angeles to produce some albums for these French artists, and with Herbie Hancock's musicians and people such as Ray Parker, and then experimenting also the work in studio and learning how to produce an album. These 3-4 years, I mean, I've been very busy by actually doing this kind of pop rock albums. But I always had in the back of my mind that it was in a way period of experimentation for something else. I didn't know exactly what, but I had this always recurrent idea of trying to create a bridge between experimentation and pop or rock music. That is something that I was continuing to do with some instrumental singles I released and quite successful in France, but also something totally, some recordings or EP or LP, totally obscure, and where we sold probably 100 copies, which is still the number, which is a number today, but yeah, not at that time.
Yeah.
respectable number today, but not at that time. And then I did Oxygen really in my kitchen, we'll talk about that, but actually something that was absolutely out of my regular activity at that time. It was because I was really producing lots of other things at the same time.
So, yeah, so from, because I've listened to the Christophe album, I can hear you playing the organ on that. I can hear, it sounds like
the eminent, yes. I mean, you see Les Mots Bleus, which is one of the best, one of the most popular song of Christophe we did together, and you hear Oxygen, you can see a kind of sound, the sound of the imminent.
That's
it. Is there.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, if you look for that, yeah, that is a massive clue as to what you're about to do.
Yeah. And it's very interesting you are mentioning that, because nobody knows that actually I used also a bit of Mellotron in these albums. And it was belonging to one of the musicians and then I got this back, but this Mellotron was broken, so lots of keys were not working anymore. And then the Mellotron, being quite important in Oxygen, is based on the only notes I could play on this Mellotron, because the rest of the keys were not working. So for the part involving Mellotron, I choose the right pitch and the right harmonies to be able to play this broken mellotron. So it's quite fun. There is a link with these sessions where, I mean, this mellotron has been destroyed in the studio it was quite okay at the beginning of the, because it was in days where we were spending months in studios for this kind of pop albums. Because I was very influenced in those days by all the concept albums from the UK, like the early Procol Harum, Grand Hotel or the King Crimson and all these kind of, albums just not being a series of songs, but just having a bigger ambition to try to do something which could have a kind of overall meaning during the whole album. So I think that I really injected that in France. And that we through these kind of albums.
Yeah.
So we were spending actually months in studios. I mean, 3-4 months in studios, Lookout. And then, this mellotron was quite okay at the beginning of these sessions. And I don't know what happened, but it was totally broken at the end of it. And then I took it back and it's a very
so
good
C
lesson.
So C worked and every key within C.
Yeah, that's
it would
right.
Be, wouldn't
yeah,
it?
That's yeah. right. It's just the third I could play. It's just some of them and it was really strange. And then I have to deal with that. And it's a very good example of how limitations in any kind of art form, how important it is.
Yeah.
And I'm convinced that the more limitations you have, the more interesting the result could be. And the
Absolutely.
Big trap these days is actually technology makes you believe that you can do everything.
Yeah.
And then it's giving you into a kind of a black hole or vertigo feeling about the fact that you say, oh my God, what can I do with this? And then when you have just a poor instruments with all broken keys, you have to deal with this and then creating something by a sense different.
Yeah.
Thank you for listening. We'll be back in the studio with Jean-Michel Jarre next week for another episode.